Welcome back, everyone. This is Austin Roberts. Here on the Ecosiv podcast, we engage leading thinkers in conversations about the kinds of transformations required to create a more sustainable, peaceful, and just world. On today's episode, Andrew Schwartz talks with David Stroh and Dr. Marilyn Paul. David is founder and principal of Bridgeway Partners, as well as the author of the best-selling book, Systems Thinking for Social Change, a practical guide to solving complex problems, avoiding unintended consequences, and achieving lasting results. He co-founded one of the first firms to apply systems thinking to learning organizations. He was also a National Science Foundation fellow at MIT, where he earned an MA in city planning. Marilyn Paul is co-founder and principal of Bridgeway Partners. She earned her PhD from the Yale School of Organization and Management and an MBA from Cornell. She served on faculties at Yale Medical School, Colby College, and Hebrew University of Public Health. She is author of two books, An Oasis in Time, and It's Hard to Make a Difference When You Can't Find Your Keys, with a third book on the way. Her work focuses on helping people integrate big picture thinking into daily behaviors and habits, while David's tends to emphasize moving from immediate experience to big picture thinking. Both approaches are vital to the deep transformation required to build a genuinely ecological civilization, which is the focus of the conversation today. And now, here's Andrew, David, and Marilyn.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Ecosiv podcast. I'm Andrew Schwartz, co-founder and vice president of Ecosiv. And I have the privilege today of talking with not one, but two brilliant people, David Stroh and Dr. Marilyn Paul. David is founder and principal of Bridgeway Partners. David's author of the best-selling book, Systems Thinking for Social Change, a practical guide to solving complex problems, avoiding unintended consequences, and achieving lasting results. Who wouldn't want to do all those things? Rightfully so, David is described as an elegant distiller of complex problems and a magician in applied systems thinking, probably my favorite title of anybody ever. David is said to have possessing of both the sort of mind of a scientist and the heart of a healer, which is, I think, a fabulous combination, unfortunately far too rare in our world today. David's also co-founder with Peter Senge of one of the first firms to apply systems thinking to learning organizations. Maybe, David, we can talk later about how you can help our organization be a learning organization off the air here. But he was also a National Science Foundation fellow at MIT, where no doubt I'm sure he was learning about systems thinking, and he earned an MA in city planning after graduating with degrees in civil engineering and urban studies from University of Michigan. With all of that, as a wonderful, brilliant person, he's perhaps best known for being the husband and partner of Dr. Marilyn Paul, or at least will be now. So Marilyn is co-founder and principal of Bridgeway Partners. She earned her PhD from the Yale School of Organization and Management and an MBA from Cornell, drawing on her extensive research in organizational science, time management, and energy management to help teams slow down their work pace long enough to discover new working systems that lead to real and lasting solutions. Of course, I'm very interested in learning more about real and lasting change. So that sounds wonderful. Marilyn serves as an idea engine, an energy leverager, and a growth catalyzer. She's also served as faculties at Yale Medical School, Colby College, Hebrew University of Public Health. And while David has authored one brilliant book, Marilyn's authored two brilliant books, with a third on the way, the first being An Oasis in Time, and It's Hard to Make a Difference When You Can't Find Your Keys. Brilliant titles. The third book, I believe, is tentatively titled It's Hard to Save the Planet When You Don't Know What to Do. Is that right, Marilyn?
That's a
telling title. So I'm thrilled to have both David and Marilyn with me today. It's also great because they work together in complementary ways. I understand that Marilyn's approach really focuses on helping people integrate big picture thinking into daily behaviors and habits. And David tends to move the other direction, from immediate experience to big picture thinking. So sort of from the bottom up, from the top down, if you wanted to provide directions to those. But both of these approaches, I think, are vital to what we might call a deep transformation that's required to build a genuinely ecological civilization, which is something I hope to explore today. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
So the language of an ecological civilization may not be familiar to you or to a lot of people. It's a phrase that's very popular in China, but not one. But we use it a little bit differently, I think, than some of the, you know, in a more globalized context, not tied directly to sort of Chinese politics. And personally, I use it as a phrase that attempts to describe a radical reorganization of sort of all the sectors of society. So rethinking economic systems and systems of governance and systems of education and systems of agriculture, all according to through the lens and the sort of principles, ecological principles of interconnection. For the long-term well-being of people on the planet. I think you'd probably agree with me. Maybe not. We'll see. But I believe the major social and environmental challenges we face are all interconnected, in that adequately responding to this sort of complex web of problems requires changing our stories, our what we think, what we say about what it means to be human in relation to the more than human world, in relation to one another, and also changing our systems, the very structure and organization of how our society is set up. And that if we want to change the world, we have to change our stories and change our systems. That's my thinking. Maybe you agree, maybe you don't. I didn't see anybody shaking their head real hard saying no. So that's good. I mean, it's okay if you disagree. I could learn something from disagreement. Anyways, I'm talking too much. Here's the thing. You two are experts, and you're experts in applying systems thinking, which means I fully expect by the end of our conversation today, you'll provide a clear path for building a more equitable, peaceful, and sustainable world, so no pressure. But I thought we might just begin a little more helpfully at the beginning with some basics, such as, what is systems thinking? And how does it differ from what we might call conventional conventional or linear thinking? That's where I think we could begin.
All right.
In the world of systems thinking.
So Donella Meadows was a global acknowledged expert in systems and systems thinking. And her definition of a system was an interconnected set of parts designed to achieve something. Now, that last word is a little bit scary. Like, what on earth is it designed to achieve? And she was quite deliberate about that word. There's a principle in systems that say they're perfectly designed to achieve what they are achieving right now. And that can be very hard for us to get our heads around, because we're experiencing typically lots of symptoms of dysfunction. And we ask ourselves, well, what on earth is this actually accomplishing? And asking that question is in fact critical to effective systems work. Because if we want to change how a system performs, we have to understand why it's behaving the way it is and what it's actually accomplishing right now. So I've defined systems thinking as understanding those interconnected set of parts in a way that achieves a desired purpose. And that really then calls into question, well, what is our desired purpose here? What are we trying to accomplish, really? And often what we find is that we've set up our systems to achieve short-term results. Short-term results for ourselves, for our part of the system. Another principle is of linear thinking, by contrast, is if you want to improve the performance of a system. You improve the performance of each of the parts and then kind of cobble it together. And what systems thinking says, actually, no, if you want to improve the performance of a system, you have to improve the relationships among the parts of the system. And we're not typically organized to do that. And so I love what you're talking about, Andrew, that it is all about connection between human civilization and the natural world, something that indigenous cultures have actually a much better understanding of over a much longer period of time than we do contemporarily. And it's interesting to see recently how there are a lot of systems thinkers are turning to indigenous cultures for deeper wisdom as well. So that's how I would define a system and systems thinking. Linear thinking, by contrast, is if I want to improve something, I apply a fix, a short term, typically a quick fix that reduces the problem symptom, but actually does not address the underlying problem. And one of the other things we know about systems is that if you can make an improvement in the short term, very often it will lead to no improvement or worse behavior in the long term. So recognizing the principles of quick fixes, of unintended consequences, and so on is important to stepping out of our linear thinking. So that's enough for me on this. Marilyn, what would you like to add, if anything?
I think I'll just say that to be a systems thinker is to be someone who is looking for and keen to understand our impact on others, keen to understand the choices that we make that we can be responsible for. I think one of the key things about systems thinking is to always be looking at our contribution to things as they are.
It's a great point, Marilyn. Yeah. And I would just add to that, you know, all of us want to be part of the solution and think that we are part of the solution. What systems thinking encourages us to do as well is to consider how we're not just part of the solution, but also part of the problem. And the reason for doing that is not to blame ourselves for the way things are, but to actually empower ourselves. Because the greatest source of control that we have over the system is ultimately through our own intentions, our own thinking, and our own behavior.
Mm. Yeah, that's beautiful. I like you had just said, I think one of the acclaimed sort of benefits of systems thinking and system solutions is that they are set up to help us avoid these unintended consequences, whereby sort of our attempts to solve a problem today accidentally actually exacerbate the problem tomorrow, or our current actions are contributing to the very problem that we're trying to solve. How do you recognize that? How do you step outside of yourself and sort of see how you're part of the problem when your goal is to be a part of the solution?
It's a great question.
I can just with a personal example. So my first book is about healing personal disorganization. And one of the things I noticed early on, this is a very personal example, but I think it might fit with what you're saying, is I would walk into my home and say, boy, it's messy in this place.
Or I'd, wait, your home or my home? Because that's very familiar. Yeah.
Or I would look on my desk and say, wow, what a pile, what a mess. So, okay, it took me a while to figure out that my actions that I was not aware of created that mess. I would look at it and think, where does this mess come from? And my first thinking, well, it's my boss's thought, he's giving me too much work, or it's my roommate's fault, but I didn't have a roommate. So after a while, I figured out, wait a sec, I'm the one making choices that lead to what I'm seeing. And it took a while to do that without saying, and you're a jerk. So one of the things, we want to leave out the blame, but we do want to look carefully to see what's going on. And one of my concerns about the conversation around climate issues is that we're all involved. Anyone in this, our so-called advanced civilization that's actively destroying the planet, is involved, is making choices that lead to what we're seeing. And I think part of a really good conversation is, how do I contribute to what I'm seeing? And how can I change my thinking? How can I live more lightly on the earth? And then we can talk later about, do individual choices make a difference, which I think they do. But how do I create what I'm seeing? So I need to choose carefully, because I think there's also been a misuse of the whole conversation about, you create your reality, which we can, let's just bracket that. But looking for a responsibility without blame, getting super curious, like more curious than we ever thought possible, noticing the thoughts going through our head where we get curious, but I really know whose fault it is. The minute we really know whose fault it is, we are not thinking systemically.
Two of the qualities of a systems thinker that we emphasize in relation to what Marilyn said is curiosity and humility. Mm. That if something isn't working, rather than either blaming others or trying to do what we have been doing with more effort, to kind of step back and say, what am I missing? What are we missing? And that requires humility, the willingness to not know, the willingness to consider that I may have a role in the problem, not just everybody else. So those, the systems thinking, and it's interesting you mentioned, Andrew, that you have a background in religion as well as philosophy. One of the things to me is that systems thinking is, it's not just about thinking, even though that's in the term. There's an emotional aspect to it, there's a behavioral aspect to it, and to me, there's ultimately a spiritual aspect. And so being a good, quote unquote, systems thinker and systems leader to us involves developing character traits, not just focusing on what we can change out there. And humility and curiosity are two of the first ones.
Ah, it's beautiful. I would love to talk sometime about the function of blame in our society and how unhelpful it is psychologically to actually accomplish the goals that we want. But we'll leave that for another time. I want to talk about complexity. I think for some of us who maybe are newer to systems thinking or are not really fully trained in it, you look at a sort of nonlinear causal looping map of systems, version. It looks like a big bowl of spaghetti, a bunch of lines and loops and words, and it's hard to follow. But when I was in high school, I had a math teacher who said, just remember to kiss, keep it simple, stupid. And despite the fact that there is a grown adult authority figure calling children stupid, I'm curious. I mean, so often we're drawn to simplicity. Yet the reality we face is one of great complexity. What do we do about that? I feel like that's at tension somehow. What do you think?
Well, I love Einstein's phrase, we need to make things as simple as possible, but no simpler. And when, even though we call them systems maps, and I know the types of spaghetti maps that you're talking about, that's not the kind of maps that I or we help people develop. We are looking for the essence in a complex problem. And one way that we tell people, even though it's called a systems map, our goal is never to map a system. It's to map the answer to a focusing question. And the focusing question begins with your favorite question word, which is why. And it's usually something along the lines of why, despite our best efforts, have we been unable to achieve this particular goal or solve this particular problem? And so the maps are not designed to map the universe, not designed to map, quote unquote, entire systems, but actually to understand the answer to those, but that particular question, with the idea of uncovering where the leverage could be in shifting. And so effective maps to us very much aim for as much simplicity as possible to capture as much of the essence of that complexity.
That's fabulous. I love that. And I love that the clarity or the clarification, right? That it's, you're not mapping the system as such. What you're really trying to map is the essence of the system, which seems much more useful than just the sort of data ad infinitum, right? I think that can, that reminds me of the sort of maybe the contrast between symptoms and causes of problems. And it seems that one of the major obstacles in sort of getting traction on systems change is that there's so much attention and resources being focused on addressing short-term symptoms of what are actually much deeper complex problems. What tips do you have for identifying what we might call root causes of complex problems?
There's a model that we use in all of our work called the iceberg. And it points to distinctions about what's happening at a particular point in time, what's been happening over time, and what's why something has been occurring over time. If we go to the bottom of the iceberg, sort of where the most pivotal and often hidden areas of cause lie, one of the things that we'll find is that they have to do with our underlying beliefs and assumptions and our underlying intentions. So if we believe that resources are infinitely expandable and available, we'll act one way. If we believe that resources exist in balance with each other and with the nature of demands, and that renewable resources are very different from those that we can extract and believe we can extract for extended periods of time without consequence, then we will choose to do something else. So when you're talking about the importance of stories, we're saying, yes, what are the stories we're telling ourselves now? And how are those stories actually making our lives more difficult? And what new stories could we tell that would allow our own lives, much less the lives of others, to be healthier?
Does that mean that if we just change our thinking, all of our problems will just fade away? Or is there something else that's a missing piece of that puzzle?
Marilyn, do you want to pick up on that?
I want to sort of flag that word just, if we just change our thinking.
It's just so easy, right? It's just, yeah.
There's a lot of work now where people talk about changing thinking, but we're talking about thoughts and beliefs, But I think as part of that, we're talking about who we think we are at a very deep level, how we relate to others. If, for example, we believe that extraction of valuable resources gives us the privilege and maybe the responsibility to use those resources well, then we think we're doing a good job if we do that. But if we actually think, wait a sec, extraction over time leads to externalities that we don't include in our understanding of value, then we might move towards a much more humble and simple life. The issue is partly when you're talking about ecological civilization, is we have this idea that we live in advanced civilization. So what if we took that notion of advanced and unpacked it and looked at advanced for whom? That's one question, but what is advanced? Are we living with deeper love and deeper care and deeper serenity and deeper well-being and really connected to the earth beneath our feet? Or do we somehow end up, all of us, in an unbidden way, wanting more? There's sort of a cultivation of an internal experience of lack that most of us can't avoid without a lot of training. And that's not just a thought. That lack is a sense. It's a felt sense that there's something always missing. And so when you said, well, do we just change our thinking? I think it's wonderful work of rebuilding communities, of connecting to our neighbors, of noticing the moments of joy that we experience, of noticing our sense of connectedness to the earth, and not focusing so hard on what we need to buy or what our to-do list is. And those are shifts in thought patterns, in patterns of feeling, and in that deep sense of well-being that I feel is a possibility.
I have a story to tell that I think will ground this as well. One of the challenges, and you really capture it in the name of your organization, is to, one of the assumptions that exists in certainly Western society is that we can have environmental conservation or economic well-being, but we can't have both. And that assumption is really problematic, and I would say incorrect. So I was asked several years ago by the Nature Conservancy in Arizona to help them prevent wildfires in northern Arizona. And they pulled together a wide variety of stakeholders from business, from government, from the social sector, from academia, to address this issue. And in the course of my doing interviews to prepare to do a systems analysis of this and facilitate, somebody said, oh, of course, the Nature Conservancy isn't an environmental organization. And I thought, wow, they've actually accomplished something to not be viewed in, of course, what this person was referencing was a negative view of environmentalists. And in fact, one of the dynamics that we uncovered is that how environmental actions, well-meaning to protect forests by not pruning them and not doing controlled burns, because that's the way nature does it, is it'll just create a fire when it needs to and it'll take care of itself and don't mess. that assumption by environmentalists had actually contributed significantly to the vulnerability of the forests. And what was required was a recognition that a certain amount of economic value needed to be gotten from the forest. There was timber that still could be harvested in economically beneficial ways, but never in a way that would produce this overall value that the forests were producing in terms of water, in terms of recreation, in terms of power, and so on, and that those non-quantifiable benefits, or not easily and obviously quantifiable benefits, were worth environmental conservation, even if the timber industry couldn't make all the money that would be required to harvest the forest in a sustainable way. So the ability to think synergistically between economic well-being and environmental well-being, to me, is a critical part of sustainable development. And something I've, from my observations, because I've done quite a bit of work with the Nature Conservancy, that the Conservancy is one organization that happens to be really good at thinking about energy.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, and thinking about conservation economies as a whole new sort of frame for how conservation is done. I think so. You were talking about in this story about bringing stakeholders together, and I think one of the things that I often do in bringing stakeholders together is to come together to sort of envision the future that we want, and working backward from that sort of common goal to identify the steps that are needed to sort of move forward toward that vision. But while it's really important, I think, to have a common goal, it also doesn't seem to guarantee alignment of action of you know, a path forward or something. And I'm curious, because I know David, and at least in your books, you talk a little bit about this idea of accidental adversaries. And I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about that and how we could avoid that trap in finding a way forward beyond just a common vision.
Well, thank you for raising that. I want to answer the question by putting accidental adversaries off to the side for a moment and come back to this question of what it takes to create alignment. And alignment is critical to bringing together the energies of very diverse people with diverse strengths, diverse resources, and often diverse interests. So in addition to having a shared sense of possibility and what people want to create, we found that it's equally important to have a shared understanding of where we are and why now. So that, you know, the old analogy is we all want to go to Chicago, and we start arguing about how to get to Chicago, and we discover some of us live on the West Coast and some of us live on the East Coast. No wonder we're arguing, because we can't even agree on where we're starting from. And what is true of most people and systems is when we take a look at where we are, we're taking a look at how we're, again, part of the solution, but everybody else is contributing to the problem. And with everybody else contributing to the problem, and I'm the only one contributing to the solution, you can't get very far. One of the other metaphors that we use is the blind man and the elephant. That what's challenging about systems work is that all of us see a different part of a much more complex whole. And the problem is we swear that the part of the quote unquote elephant that we're in touch with is the whole thing rather than just a part of it. And part of our work is to help people see the larger whole that they are all a part of, why reality operates the way it does now, so that they don't continue in what is often starts as an adversarial relationship, but by recognizing how we're not only just want this, you know, or want something together, but that ultimately we're collectively creating our current state, and we collectively need to be responsible for redesigning that current state to get us where we want to go.
That's fabulous. So you reference this idea of sort of stepping back and seeing the whole, right? The whole elephant, not just
as much as one can.
So I know that something both of you really specialize as is this considering the big picture. I'm curious, I mean, is bigger always better? Are systems thinkers just the Texans of ideas, right? You know, the bigger the idea, the better it is. I mean, because here's my worry. How do you avoid losing sight of the trees for the forest? You know, it's usually the opposite. It's usually the problem, right? You get lost in the details and you lose sight of the big picture. But how do you make use of the big picture without sort of getting lost in it? Sometimes getting lost in the scope of it, the abstractness of it, the overwhelming complexity of it. What grounds you in that process of engaging with the big picture?
I want to just say something about listening. What we're talking about is partly facilitating conversations where people actually start letting go of their hold on their perspective and making space for other people's perspectives. And so then what the big picture is not necessarily big so much as it is relational. So that when you start grasping that, oh, I am sure that when I'm touching the leg of the elephant, that the elephant is just made up of sort of thick, wrinkly, tough skin. And I am not open at all to the idea that there's also a wavy trunk. So we're starting off to create a relational picture of reality and developing that sense that maybe I don't know everything, or even what I am solid on perceiving might not be the whole picture. So that's one thing to consider when we're thinking about what do we do with the big picture. And the big picture is actually made up, in my view, of many small perceptions and choices. So while I don't want to get confused between abstraction and perception and shared perception. So that's just a thought about, oh, we've got this big picture. You know, when we really are aligned and we really have a common understanding of where we are, and we're willing to look for leverage points, we're willing to not have it quote unquote our way, we start moving as a group or as a collective towards a type of sanity, right? And so that's my response to what you're saying. A lot of what I do right now is help people see that they are valuable, that they matter, that the story is we're all in this together, that retired people with a certain amount of resources can't just say, well, it's the kid's problem. And this is, and then we start to see there are shifts in our thinking that lead to shifts in our choices that lead to shifts in our actions, and those actions influence each other. It's never one or the other.
One of the things I love about Marilyn's work in this area is that she's passionate about conversations. And one of the things that I came to see over the years is that it's not what the maps are, the quote unquote systems maps, the loops, et cetera, et cetera. It's what they do. And good maps facilitate different conversations among people. Conversations where they're looking inward, not just outward. Conversations where they're understanding not only how others are impacting them, but how they are impacting others. And how collectively we're creating something that no one really wants, that may meet some, yes, immediate needs, but at such a huge cost to what we care about more deeply, that it's not worth to continue the way we've been continuing, and that there are other ways to go.
Yeah, that's, so I think you touched on something there that I want to pull out a little bit, and that's this, maybe it's a tension between sort of the focus on addressing immediate threats and that sort of sense of urgency, yet also the need to look up and consider the long-term perspective. And how do you help people find that balance between, let's say, thinking globally, but also acting locally, thinking long-term, but solving problems in the present? I think as Marilyn was alluding to, this sort of both and, not an either or, but how do you find that both and space? And how do you help your clients do that?
Marilyn, do you want to address that in relation to how you're thinking about your book and the various levels that you're encouraging people to reflect on?
Yeah, say more about your new book.
Sure. Well, one thing I'll just say, because Andrew, I feel like that's a critical issue, is that when we're really engaged in solving personal sort of, or anything immediate, like we can galvanize energy to overcome a crisis, and we like doing that. We worked for an organization that was able to galvanize massive amounts of energy to respond to people who were left homeless by fires here in California. But what they also noticed is that once people were housed in maybe homes, maybe RVs, the interest in energy died down. So I hear your question is, how do we maintain energy and care for the future and for the present? And to me, part of it is, again, noticing that it's easier to engage our energy when something is right in front of us. It seems real, it looks real, we like the camaraderie, we act together, we're almost in battle mode, and there's camaraderie there. And I think part of it to me is the conversations we have, but where we have them. What if we had a fabulous potluck dinner once a month? That's going to sound like I'm not answering your question. But as humans, we like to socialize. We like to eat. We like to make music. I have a friend who's working with people to do a river cleanup in Ecuador. But she also, so people are there, they're cleaning up, but they also brought in musicians and chefs, so that the feeling of the cleanup isn't over once the river is cleaned up, because they've built community. And that's a human love to dance, to sing, to make music, to eat, to share. So what's happened there is that community is really finding a way to move on to other projects and to think more about an Andes project and think more long-term, and they're actually engaging in policy change, but there's always food and there's always music. So one of the things I think we need to do is build community and connect with our young people and experience the longevity of our stories, that we need to tell stories that say, we're in this for the long haul, and that's in the stories, the food, the music, the people, and that keeps the energy up.
So in terminology that I use, Marilyn's story about Ecuador is a wonderful example of a small success in relation to a longer term aspiration and longer term strategy. And we need small successes to create energy, to create momentum, to create enthusiasm for the next cleanup, the larger cleanup, whatever. It's important to distinguish those small successes, which we need to cultivate, from quick fixes. Because quick fixes is what gets us into trouble, and quick fixes are taken without much consideration of the long-term impacts of our action. We're simply trying to react, to put out the fire, to deal with the crisis as it exists, get it off our plate and move on to something else. And it's that type of reactive thinking and behavior that gets us into deeper trouble over time. By contrast, again, what Marilyn's talking about is, what are those small successes that we can create that really will build even more momentum and energy and resource toward what we ultimately want?
And it's also community, though. When we feel good about the people we're working with, and we value them, and we can share a meal with them, was part of early on in the farm workers, a lot of meetings were held over potlucks. And we need to remember that when we're working on the environment. So the energy of community is the energy of the future. And when we have our to-do lists and we're feeling productive and we've checked off the list of actions, if that's how we're thinking, then let's make sure that we are checking off, be kind to this person, ask this person about their mother who's been in the hospital. If it has to be a checklist, so be it. But eventually we'll get it off of the checklist into our heart.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I love it. Great stories and great advice. I think that probably just dovetails right into the next question I had in my mind, which is, what advice do you have for people at home who they're interested in, sort of they're drawn to these big ideas for building a better world, but they don't really know where to begin?
Yeah. That's why I'm writing my book. My book is called, right now, it's the working title, It's Hard to Save the Planet When You Don't Know What to Do. But saving the planet really involves saving our neighborhood. It involves building our relationships. And so people are like, well, should I really go ahead and buy an electric vehicle, or should I put that money into a heat pump? Okay, fine. Those are good things to be thinking about. And part of what I do is I help people consider that they themselves, in their place, with their talents and skills, with their relationships, and with their passions, they can start treasuring those and look for what really is the right thing for me to do, always with a buddy or with a group. Like, we're looking for, how do I impact the situation positively? I would say, start by making friends who share that concern. Have conversations with the friends. Tell them what you're passionate about. Like my friend in Ecuador, who loves food and music and cleanups, put it all together, build a community. It's going a little bit against our grain. We are really trained to make a list of action steps and take action. The challenge with that is when we feel small, like it doesn't matter what I do, when we feel overwhelmed, like I can't focus, it's all a blur. When we feel exhausted, I'd rather watch Netflix. When we feel disconnected and isolated and we're telling ourselves that we're doomed, we're not going to take action no matter how much we break it down into a doable step. So having said all of that, that's why the book will be about relationship, about connection. It will include the to-do lists, but with a slightly different angle, which is anytime you write down an action step, who are you doing it with? Who are you being accountable to? Who are you doing it for? So you feel the relationality of your actions. And I feel that's who we are as humans. We are sociable. We are relational. We love at the core, you know, the big discovery from the 75-year Harvard Grant study was, what is success? It's love. Mm. And if we can go into our hearts and feel what we really want for each other, for our children, for people, for ourselves, it's not going to be a better trip to Morocco. What it really is going to be is better connections, more celebrations, being there for people, escorting them, being present as they pass to the next life. So, and everyone's needed, speaking of Morocco, because I brought it up, they passed an amazing bill, no plastic bags. Morocco was the first country to ban plastic bags. Well, that's great, except now there is a big black market in plastic bags. Why? Because people love their plastic bags and they didn't want the new bags and they were a little more expensive and they weren't bought in. They didn't see why. So why plastic bags? There's lots of good reasons, but until everyone really grasps that they are part of it, we can pass all the policies we want, but we need to engage the hearts and minds of every single person.
That is fantastic. I really look forward to reading your book when it's out. I think, so I mean, we're coming to a close here. I just think that too often it's easy to get caught up and focused on what we're against. And in that process, losing sight of what we're for. And in the face of these sort of complex global issues, I just have one, maybe, I don't know, a deceptively simple question. What gives you hope?
I love the quote from Václav Havel, along the lines of, hope is knowing that you're doing the right thing, no matter how it turns out. Mm. And so there, I believe that part of the spiritual aspect of this work is that we have a conscience, and that conscience does help us distinguish right from wrong and what is healthy and positive from what isn't. And I think that we were motivated to kind of align with our conscience in some ways, whether we like it or not. And so, you know, you can look at biblical stories where God was telling them to do something, and they were going, no, not me. I'd rather it be somebody else. Thank you very much. And yet there is this kind of nagging, no, this is not right. What is right is. And to live our lives in accordance with whatever that sense of rightness is, I think is hope in and of itself. Marilyn?
I think what gives me hope right now is that living in an ecological way is very satisfying. We have the possibility of seeing through and feeling through and thinking through the story of our civilization, which is we need more, we have to have more, we have to nicer everything, to see through that story and discover that as humans, we have infinite value at just as we are. And that that actually feels better than accumulating consumer goods. And we can speak to that. We might say, oh yeah, no, I don't need to buy so much. But to actually have that experience of care and reconnect with people and forgive the people who have hurt us and find ways of making new good friends who matter, and then being together with them, I think that's one thing that gives me hope. The other, I don't know if you've seen this, but I want to mention the movie Kiss the Ground about regenerative agriculture. It's narrated by Woody Harrelson. And what they're learning in the world of regenerative agriculture is that land that looks wasted, that looks like a desert, can be restored. Mm-hmm. And that the food we choose to eat and stop throwing it away, because we do keep throwing food away like we think it's going somewhere, to treasure again our meals, our people, our gatherings, and that's what this movie is about. And so that gives me hope. There's lots and lots of people who are involved with trying to create a greater ecological civilization. Mm.
That gives me hope as well, as does talking to the two of you. And all the work that you're doing, helping to connect people and to sort of guide people around the world to build the future that we want. So I really appreciate you taking the time to share with me. Is there anything, final insights and nuggets of wisdom you'd like to leave us with?
I think I'll just say that reducing the overwhelm that we feel through planning hours, a day of rest, every week, to really deliberately set aside our lists and our achievements and our aspirations deliberately is transformational, because it reminds us who we are. So that's my little sort of last thought. Make sure to rest. And rest with other people and celebrate whatever we can celebrate.
And I think for me, it's being willing to keep asking the question, how am I unwittingly contributing to the difficult situation that I'm in or we're in? And with that insight, to regain some capacity to do something about it.
You know, David, you had mentioned that you and Marilyn are complementary, and I think you've definitely proven that today. These two final insights are absolutely beautifully complementary. So thanks again for your time and for your wisdom. Of course, any of those who are listening and want to learn more about applying systems thinking for social change and about big picture thinking for the well-being of people on the planet, I'd encourage you to check out Bridgeway Partners. We'll put a link in the episode description. And any of the right now three, but almost four books that David and Marilyn have written, other great sources of information. So thank you both.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
To talk with you.